Blog Talk Radio.
To envision a world with white folks, without white folks, and be able to raise the question, what is it that we're going to do independent of white people? It is very, very hard for us to envision a world without white people. But we cannot create our own agenda until and unless we can define an agenda that can envision a world in which they don't exist. Now we have to wake up and come back to the reality of them. But certainly when we talk about a future, we have to talk about a future from our point of view and our historical understanding of reality.
Hetepu, Ndamana, Ndamanesh, Nangadef, Habargadi, Majwo, Salbona, Anisogoma, Peace, War, Pan-African Greetings Family. My name is Kamau Mackaysi Tahuti. You've entered Africa's Reascension. We'll start like we usually start with an apai or a libation, which deliberately calls upon the energies of our African gods, our African spirit forces, and the forces of those yet born to bless and guide this endeavor. I go. Odomakuman, Inyame, Inyamewa, the Treaty of Poem, Oloveron, Amen, Amen Ra, Pata, Bejeansa, Asasayansa, Abasuninsa, Abasunpoansa, Nana Sergibiansa, Nana Esiketuansa, Nana Dadakofiansa, Nana Kumiansa, Nana Tigray, Yansa. Kweku Free Yansa. Akonadi Abena Yansa. Asubontan Yansa. Ocherewa Yansa. Taminsa Yansa. Nananom in Samanfo Yansa. In Samanfo Abasu Ofao Yansa. Abasum Abasu Ofao Yansa. Yeshremo Yansa, Yeshremo Ahuda, Yeshremo Enchera, Yeshremo Sikapa, Yeshremo Enkwasu, Yeshremo Enkwasu Abasu Ofao, Ye Enkwasu. I ask that you, Odomakama, Inyamewa, Treaty Upon, Olorun, Amen, Amen Ra, Ptah, to use me and this forum to impart clarity and cultural consistency to all within the sound of my voice. May I speak directly to your soon, your spirit, and reawaken the long, dormant, and asleep African inside. Medasi Pa, Medasi Bio, Mo Piafo, Mo Nekasa, Medasi Nanano, Yo Medasi Nanano. What you just witnessed, what you just heard, again, is the Apae, Apae, A-P-A-E, it's a Twi term for libation, and it's an ancient practice that is still done to this day in all rural traditional areas throughout the continent. Past, present, and future become one, as those of tomorrow look upon what we are doing now in drawing strength from and doing the rituals of yesterday. Again, this is Kamau Mackaysi Tahuti, and you have entered Africa's Reascension. Ah, man. We are going to get back on topic for a minute. in a minute. But as folks know who listen on the computer, I follow immediately after Mr. Holipsism's show. And today he had a very good topic as far as the mind fuck of leadership. And the chat, some of the chat room comments sort of got me at odds, sort of got me just thinking again, and you know, I think we all get like this at some point, but what's the point of all of this? What are we fighting for? For folks who listened to the show last week, for the first hour we were on topic, talking about the New Orleans uprising of 1811, and then Brother Yao Kepler called in right around the second hour, and even though it wasn't on topic, I let the talk go on because it was something that was very needed, and he was asking basically the same question. What are we liberating for? What are we going towards liberation for? What are we going towards nation building for? And over again, it seems like we just want to get white folks off our back, and that's it. We think that if we become liberated, we think that if we build up just our own nation, then the whole rest of the world will fall in line and everything will be fine, and that no other work on looking and watching other nations will need to take place. But with Holipsism show, some of the stuff that was in the chat room just got me thinking that there are some people who are well-intentioned, and they have, I think, good hearts, but they don't really want to listen. They don't want to put their ego aside and listen to possibly some other ways of attacking the situation. They don't want to look at doing something new, doing something potentially different. Almost every idea that I heard on the show has been something, if we really looked and studied our history, has been tried and failed before. Brother Holipsism started off his show beautifully when he made the point that when a quote-unquote leader is alive, folks, you know, we sort of deal with them with a long-handled spoon. Then when they die, we want to recite and quote every single syllable that they said or that they wrote down. And he made the point of, we never take what they said and what they did to the next fucking level. We only want to do exactly just what they did, not taking the time that they were around and the circumstances that created them and created all that stuff. We don't take that into account. We want to take the exact words of Marcus Garvey from 1920, try to make them applicable for 2011 Gregorian calendar, and expect the exact same results. We still want to freaking march and protest Like Brother King was doing today, even though crackers have become way more sophisticated in those short 40, 51 years. We want to do the exact same stuff. And then Holup made the point of, so, and then if they come back, if these leaders that we talk about, if they didn't come back and look at what we're doing now, they're going to be pissed off because the folks just want to do what they did and not take what they did to the next level. And then that connects with my earlier point. Taking stuff to the next level means going out on a limb and actually trying something new. Taking stuff to the next level means Bob Omawale, what worked with Garvey, fusing all those three things together and then throwing away what didn't work for those three, that may be what moves us to the next level. But it is so far, few and far between of people who want to do that. These leaders are sacrosanct. You can't critique them in any way. You can't say one negative thing about them in a respectful way. They will throw you out of the wherever you're speaking. And we look at our situations today and still wonder why. We get into these blog talk programs and think we're saying some shit deep by saying the exact same thing of what somebody else said 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago when it worked for them then, not taking into account new situations, new environments, new sophisticated tactics. Garvey ain't had to deal with the internet and all the BS that's on TV. They ain't even had TVs in the freaking 20s, so they ain't had to deal with that. Bob Omawale ain't had to deal with the internet and all this confusion. King, there are different dynamics in place today, people. So we have to study these people, figure out what worked, figure out what didn't work, take those things that did work, fuse them together, add in new ideas, because you got this whole new African-centered movement that's here today that as far as philosophically, and it's a lot more broken down and understood and stuff now, that wasn't there when Garvey was around, that wasn't there when King was around, and was just in that beginning embryonic stage when Omawale was around, because for folks that know the research, it was Dr. Clark who helped helped give Bob Omawale his OAAU speech and did the research for him. So and for folks who listen, Dr. Clark, he will tell you his personal relationship with Bob Omawale. So this African Center movement was just in this germinating phase, embryonic phase, when Bob Omawale was around. But we got all that information now. Folks don't want to do nothing different. And we don't think, those of us who call ourselves conscious, we don't think that we are also affected by white supremacy. By calling ourselves conscious, we are now totally cured and completely cured, and therefore we don't have to look at ourselves and our own ideas and actually see if any of this shit is working. So we can keep saying stuff over and over and over again, thinking we all deep and saying some deep stuff, but then want to critique somebody who's on the same side as you, but that person is challenging the actual feasibility of what you're trying based on history, not based off of ego needs, just we tried that shit in 54, we tried that in 60, we tried that in 67, and it only got us so far. So let's add this information in. Let's do this a bit differently. And then you get little blog talk shows talking against you and stuff like that. But okay, I'm calm. So, yeah. Resistance to Enslavement, Phase 3. That was my little rant, I guess. Magnificent show, hold up. It really was, just towards that last hour there. Resistance to Enslavement, Phase 3 on Foreign Soil, Part 2. Like I already said, we were taught where the focus of today's talk is American Uprising by Caucasoid Daniel Rasmussen. He put together this book that finally gives nationwide attention to the largest American enslaved African revolt on this soil, January 8th, 1811. 7 years off the heels of the successful enslaved African revolt over in Haiti. And that one was almost 200 years removed from the successful enslaved African revolt in Palmares. That was around 1605, I think that's when that one started. So tonight we'll finish up with the New Orleans Uprising of 1811 and continue from there. So play a promo, play some music, and finish up.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
Peace, family. This is your brother, Hollop, a.k.a. Mr. Holipsis, a.k.a. the Buzz Killer. Tune in to Holipsism's Haven every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we discuss the social, economic, and political issues of the day with a common-sense approach, an African-centered perspective, and a universal sensibility. Call in number 347-843-4874. That's 347-843-4874. To check out related YouTube videos, blogs, and show archives, visit www.holipsism.com. That's www.holipsism.com. I'm making it hard to get your Negro on. Hotep, Black Power.
There's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad.
Grandfather killed my great-great-grandfather, and your white-great-grandfather sold my great-grandfather, and your white-grandfather raped my grandmother, and your father stole, cheated, lied, and robbed my father. What kind of a fool would I have to be to say, come, my friend, to the white daughter and son?
We should always begin with the African worldview, with the African Asili, as it were, the Asili, the cultural seed, the essence of the culture. Because that is our grounding, that is our frame of reference. And without an understanding of the African worldview, we really cannot critique European thought and European behavior effectively. We need that foundation that comes from outside of the European worldview. We cannot critique European thought and behavior functioning within their framework. We have to come outside of it. And for us, what comes from our nature is our understanding of the world, the way in which we relate to the world, and the seed from which our culture develops. And
exist in a state of vainglorious, as we are protected by the red, the black, and the green. Heed the words of the brother, Sissy.
Let us the words, the phrase, the paragraph. Heed masters, J begins class. The science of past is now brought to the rhyme space. From the scrolls, state to the verses. God to God, from God to man. Many kings, many leaders, a fist from a hand. They call me militant, now what does this mean? Do I carry a gun to the army team? With the cause I never pause, there simply is a brother. Raise the flag, wave the colors. Red, black, green with the key, the difference. Words make a way in the world in an instant. Living to die and I die to live again. 3 degrees. Comprehend, a man getting stronger till he's man no longer. Unearthly state makes the time move shorter. The ever radiant awareness, brought forth the one. Open eye, stroke sun. Practicing priest, standing by what I teach. So you all stand starving as I start to leave. Words of love. Brought from the Genesis. Will exist till Armageddon is a witness. The originals built the earth. One must be aggression to learn a basic lesson. Quite majestic, stern within reality. A juggernaut when you tamper with mentality. I wear a crown, extension and dimension of a brain cell. Bringing hell to the spell out. The ever tangled web we weave. Always trying to obtain, no attempt to achieve. Descendants of kings and queens act like justice. Never potential, caught up in the measure. Jealousy of what are we? Become tendency for their thievery. Alright, cool. But no need to pull the trigger, that's a fool. I get my words like shit in my tool to produce the words that they fool about. It's another way of tricking out these pissies who may try to extinct my principality. But of course, not telling me madness. From beginning, I'm the end. Observe me. Ignorance is not a trend. So as I beckon for a few seconds, pull the reins and use the words of the brother. One with the universe, mastering words on the verse. Funk is a force I exert. Egyptian, African, now I'm on a black watch. Check my sundial, slipping like the clock. I can catch a shadow as the moon reflects the sun. Creator's eyes make a path of brother one. So now I walk softly and carry a big stick, a bird stick, so you natives pull a lick. They brings the funk and spreads jam to the wheat bread. And the funk of this one vanglorious, unearthly resistance, strong with persistence, grand verbal application, tribal connection, pyramids, witness the funk bearer, vibe sharer, not the era. Brother is balanced like the scales of Thor, and even my demand may stone you for corrupt old systems, positive poison of me. Some call it onk, it's a key. Black is a color while blackness, state of a mind state. But how many of you fake? Today, Brother J can find a better way, so be it. Plan it down and make it say I serve a purpose. Yet I'm not the G.I. Joe, I am the brother. Yo, I can never swear a purpose. Just taking your step to the mic and stage area as I drop the science that breaks the clock barrier. Words of old make me more than a beginner. The key opens knowledge and plays in the center. Americana man, Africana brother. Don't forget the land, cause the birth is from the mother. A vibe is in place, obtained and discovered. Tune in your audio and hear the words of brother.
Yo, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, step on.
Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, step off. Again, that now y'all know that was X-Clan, Heed the Words of the Brothers. And then that fed right beautifully into what was played before that with Mama Rimbaani. We got to go outside of this system to properly critique it. And that is the one lesson that we have not got, period. Period. There's too much to go with that one. We are in a reality box, and I'm going to get on topic. We are in a reality box right now, and this reality box, unfortunately, isn't our reality. It's the European reality box, and about 1% of us are willing to acknowledge that and then fight to get out of that box, or at least move to the edge of the box where you try to poke a hole in the box. Most of us do not acknowledge we are in a reality box. So then everything that we do is based upon some type of European idea. Everything that we do is based on some type of European idea. Now, this is a side from what I'm talking about, but it's related to the topic. So yesterday, the author was at the bookstore, Daniel Rasmussen of American Uprising, the book we've been talking about last week, and we'll get to this week. And so he was talking about the book, and I'll share some of that in a minute. And a questioner got up. It was a brother, well, at least a person with black skin. He asked him, Now, remember, I just said we're in a reality box, and only 1% acknowledge that we are in someone else's reality. So, his question was, do you think that the people who put together the revolt were influenced by Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan? Personally, I've never read, and I don't care to read, Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan. I guess it's got something to do with resistance or challenging power or something like that. I don't know. If there's folks in the chat who has read it or know about it, y'all can put it in there and school me. But I'm sitting there in my chair fuming because I'm like, why in the hell would an African-type resistance movement by stolen Africans in America fighting for their liberation, why would them fighting for their liberation have to be rooted in them reading some shit from Thomas Hobbes? Why can't it be Africans naturally want to be free and don't want to be enslaved, and so they're fighting for their freedom just on that alone? Why would that question even the fuck come up in somebody's head that the only way you would even want to rebel against this great system is if you were moved and motivated by the words of Thomas Hobbes and his Leviathan and some white boy? I wanted to jump out of my chair and jump that dude. Oh my. We are in another group's reality in total. And if we are not consciously and deliberately fighting against that, that is our default reality. And too many of us, especially those that put the cute little label conscious after themselves, don't want to acknowledge that one simple fact. And then they say they've heard and read Amos Wilson, but he's got what he calls his five slave constants. and folks in the chat room who know about his slave constants, y'all can say I'm in rot of that. And he walks through, Amos tells us, we haven't changed one whit from the slave consciousness that our great-great-great-great ancestors have. Because when you boil it all down, we were brought over here to make crackers money. At that time, it was for free labor, and now they give us a little bit of crumbs off the table. But if you just want to keep it on that one point, that fundamental relationship has not changed one bit. And then since he was a psychologist and a psychiatrist, we can get a whole lot deeper into how that hasn't changed one bit from back then to right now. But that question just pissed me off to no end. Were these revolters moved by Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan? Did you see anything that maybe they had read that or come across? No, fool. They understood they were in a different reality. They understood that reality was not what they wanted, and they rose up and fought against it. Everything does not have to be within the European reality for us to want to change against it. We don't always have to be motivated by something that we got out of the European reality to want to change against it. Just knowing that we're Africans, knowing that that's a different reality from this crap we're going through now, and then wanting to execute and create that new reality, that's what motivates folks who know. Not no damn Thomas Hobbes Leviathan. Anyway, okay. So I'm going to get back on point. So like I said, so the author was where I was here in D.C., and so I gave the intro for him. And so I want to share with y'all what I wrote and what I shared. There's about maybe 200 folks in the audience, and about 80% of them was white. But for folks that know me, y'all know I don't care. To some degree, Kamau means quiet warrior, and so you got to play that game that way. But I still try to slip in some stuff for the other 20% of the audience that was there. So imagine this. This is what I said to an 80% white, 20% African audience dealing with a book on the largest slave revolt in America. Quilombo, Palmares independence in Brazil, 1605. Haitian Revolution, 1804. New Orleans Uprising, 1811. These three examples of stolen African independence movements have some things in common. They all employed armed struggle and resistance to European incursions. They also show that there was a continuous strain of resistance to European colonization that flies in the face of the more popular yet incorrect enslavement narrative accounts that we went along peacefully and docilely into enslavement. What is different about these three stolen African independence movements is that while Quilombo has a feature-length movie talking about it, and the Haitian Revolution is known about by millions, up until this work, American Uprising, the longest text dealing with the New Orleans Uprising was a mere 44 pages. On January 8, 1811, upwards to 500 stolen Africans in New Orleans, armed with guns, canines, axes, and a driving determination for freedom exercised then what stolen Africans need to look at today, 2011. They chose not to assimilate into a foreign way of life, nor did they want to integrate into and become president of a foreign way of life. They resisted and fought against that foreign way of life with the end goal of reestablishing life on their terms, their way. Even though I jumped right into the cover-up chapter to see how this magnificent story had escaped my and other historians' gazes, you have to read American Uprising from the beginning. The way Mr. Rasmussen tells the story is to be applauded. He starts by briefly laying out the horrors of enslavement, capture, boat ride, auction block. Then he details what was going on in America proper and in Louisiana specifically. He masterfully weaves the backstory of the four masterminds behind the uprising, Kwaku, called Kook, Kwabena, the records call him Kwabena, Harry Kenner, and Charles Delonde. Some beginning concerns were quickly jettisoned when I saw Mr. Rasmussen did rightly link what happened only 7 short years prior in Haiti with this New Orleans uprising. And the revolt chapter was done admirably. Although this uprising did not prove successful in the end, with Mr. Rasmussen's dutiful scholarship, we now have another link in the long chain of resistance to European colonization to acknowledge. We have more names of resistance to call upon, and we have one more resistance story to pass on to present day stolen African children. So yeah, so that was the intro that I gave the author of American Uprising. And as you notice, I'm not a big fan of the term African American. I think that's some BS because we've never been, because it's stolen land, and we were brought over here as property. And so now that sort of has changed, I'm going to identify with it. No, we are stolen Africans. 2011, Gregorian calendar, 6251, the Kemetic calendar, we are still stolen Africans away from home. And so in a black audience, in a white audience, that's the phrase that I use. And... And it's true. We should get a hold of this book. We should remember the names of Kwaku, Kwamina, Harry Kenner, and Charles Delon. And we should be telling the future generations about this story. Again, even though it wasn't successful in the end, just the fact that we took up arms and fought for our freedom. We didn't try to agitate legislature. We didn't protest and march and vote and have fucking write-in campaigns. No. These brave men sought to take over the city of New Orleans. And just like with Haiti, make New Orleans another black republic. So last week, we basically went through and we were right up to the revolt chapter, or the revolt in play. We walked through the backstory of Charles Delon, and I butchered his name last week because I don't speak French. So it's DESLONDS, and so, but that last name is French, and so I guess they don't pronounce the S's, you know, like in D.C., they don't pronounce the R's, you know, or they don't pronounce the A's, everything. Instead of Mary, it's Murray. Instead of Carrie, it's Curry. Anyway, so if they're French, I guess they don't pronounce the S's, and so I said Deslondes or something last week, but it's Charles Delon. And so we went through his backstory in the sense of he was the trusted head man, and he was the overseer, and he would come down on the other enslaved Africans, and he was given a bit. He was the one to take the message up the coast to other enslaved African owners, and he'd go see his wife and that stuff. So he had some mobility and stuff, unlike a lot of enslaved Africans. So when Manuel Andry saw him leading the first wave of the revolt in his house, on his plantation, it shocked the hell out of him. And even though he got away with his life, the enslaved Africans took out his son. And as Mr. Rasmussen brings up in the book and in his talk, that was probably the first mistake of the revolt, letting Manuel live. And we'll get to that in a minute. So, yeah, we went through. We went through, you know, a few of the scenes that were created as far as us burning down plantations, as far as us killing white folks, as far as what the motivation of the revolt for, what the end goal of it was to be. We spoke upon how the drum, the African drums, came with them, and every time they were about to engage, they were employed, and not just for musical entertainment, not just, I'm going to get you sucky, you know, every hero needs his theme music. No, it wasn't like that. The African drum then, as it is now, helps move us, helps motivate us. If you know the right rhythms, you can call down different energies to help them doing what you're doing. And again, we know that a lot of the people within this revolt were Khan, were Yoruba, were Mende. More and more of that information is coming out. And I just stumbled across a website that was actually, and I asked the author about this, I asked him, did he know? It's, I put it in the chat room too. It's 1811slaverevolt.com. And basically, some folks in Florida got together, and they didn't work, you know, together and in tandem with him. I guess they may have saw his book or came across it themselves, and then went and started this project. But basically, it goes through the timeline of what happened. And they went through a lot of the court cases and got a lot of names of people who were involved. And yeah, it gives you a bit of background. It walks through, like I said, the court cases, the BS court cases, calendar events, timeline, background information, and documents. But like I say, they did some detailed work on getting at least as many of the names as, you know, they could come across of the folks that were actually involved in the revolt. And like I said earlier, we can add some of these folks' names to what actually happened. There's pictures. They have a few pictures here. One of the pictures looks like one of the plantations that we burned down along the revolt. They have another picture of a line drawn of the smoke filling the skies from different plantations being burned down. So, yeah, so like I said, let me put this in the chat room. 1811slaverevolt.com. And it's you know, a small but nice amount of information, again, talking about this before Mr. Rasmussen's research hadn't really been talked about. You would have had to have been in New Orleans to get the real information about this. And he gives, Daniel gives full, the Caucasoid gives full credit to the people in New Orleans that he talked to, the community activists and the children, the great-great-grandson, the great-great-great-granddaughter or whatnot, of the folks that participated in it. And so we need to make sure we share this information and get it to as wide of an audience as we can. And that's what I'm trying to do here. So, yeah, 1811slaverevolt.com. And so, yeah, so then we went through and Francois Trepanier, we talked about how he was told about the army coming to him, and he was like, this is a ragtag bunch of folks. So he sent his wife and his child out to the swamps, and he felt he was going to, you know, go up to the second floor and hold ground and be able to shoot a few warning shots, and these ragtag folks were just going to, you know, cower and run away. But we know that didn't happen. Trepanier's estimation of the slave's strength and his decision to stay behind proved dead wrong. This is coming from page 109. Kwaku led a party behind the plantation house up to the second story. As other enslaved Africans lit fire to the foundations, Kwaku took his axe and hacked Francois Trepanier to pieces. Hacked him to pieces. Local legend has it that Gustave II swung an axe, exacting final vengeance for years of patronizing mistreatment. And Gustave was an African who Trepanier had in his house, and he treated him as his house pet, treated him as a dog. And the only way that Gustave would be fed is he would throw scraps off his table. Trepanier had a long history of just being like extra mean and vicious with his enslaved African people. And so they definitely wanted to make sure that they took this cracker out, and they did. And Gustave was able to get a little bit of retribution for his years of horrible treatment from this specific Caucasoid. Coming from 110, only through extermination and extreme violence could they earn the right to form a separate political community, to be recognized as men rather than slaves. Violence was simply the price they had to pay for freedom. And Gilbert Andrie and Francois Trepanier were the down payment. Inspired by the Haitian victory over Napoleon's army, the rebel leaders were not unreasonable in imagining that they could defeat the Americans' small colonial army. So, yes, yeah, so that all transpired on January 8, 1811. And then you move to January 9th. And again, they continued going towards the black slaves of New Orleans were the first to arise on January 9th. As their masters slept, the slaves began preparing for the day, readying the horses, lighting the fires, and cleaning the houses. Slaves formed a great underclass of the city, serving as laundry women, delivery boys, cleaners, construction workers, carriage drivers, cooks, peddlers, boatsmen, and manual laborers of all sorts. So, yes, yeah, so on January 9th, they were sort of, so on January 9th, the governor, Governor Claiborne, that bastard, he finally got wind of what had happened. And so I don't know if I mentioned this last week. If I did, I'm sorry. So he, and he heard it from his top general, Wade Hampton. And so the American military at that time, they were fighting a war. They were fighting the Spanish for control of the Florida territory. And so the majority of their of the American military at that time was over there. So they couldn't really send reinforcements. They were able to send 60 folks. 60 military folks to help out what was going on in New Orleans. And so they were led by Wade Hampton. And so I wanna find the passage where to go. Yeah. Where'd the passage go? I'm sorry. Give me a moment. One day. Okay. There we go. Okay, so yeah, so you got these 60 military folks who were set in to squelch the rebellion, if you will. And so now they're still moving forward. We're still doing our thing. And, oh, wait, that's not it. Damn it. Okay, well, I'll go back to what we were doing on January 9th. January 9th was where the Maroons of New Orleans, a few of them, joined the revolt. Here, finally, Maroons began to join the insurrection at the plantation of Alexandre LaBranche. The longtime Maroons, Reuben and Kofi, left the swamps and joined the revolt. Following their lead, a wave of swamp denizens gave up the security of their wooded retreats to fight with the rebel army. And so that helped, you know, swell the numbers too, because like I said, the accounts say between 200 and 500, and there's no real solid number. If you just go by the court documents and all of that, there's 125 folks that he said he can prove were there. But then the eyewitness accounts, again, it varies from 200 to 500. So, of course, you know, I'm going to move towards the higher number, but and definitely with, you know, Maroon help, they won't, those numbers wouldn't be fully accounted for because they had left the society. So you won't have records of them there. How come I can't find this poem? Basically, when the 60 American military folks They came up to a plantation, and it was lit, and they had got information from a sellout that that they may be, that this is where they may be boss. And so these military folks come up to this plantation, and they said it looked like folks had been there. It looked like this army had been there. And I am so mad. And so by the time that they had got, oh, there we go. Okay. Hampton and the planters met to arrange a plan of attack, delaying any abrupt movement in favor of a well-organized strike. They knew what was at stake. The order of the attack was formed the moment the troops reached the ground, infantry and seamen so disposed as to enclose by forward movement three sides of the small enclosure, which embraced the building, and the horse at the first signal was to charge the other. The infantrymen and the seamen crept into position. The horsemen steeled themselves for a bold cavalry charge. At the crucial moment, Hampton ordered them to attack. Horses galloped, guns fired, and soldiers shouted into the night. But no enemy returned fire. As the soldiers penetrated the walls and fences and began to search the buildings, they found only a few unarmed slaves. The bulk of the slave army had retreated. In his report to headquarters, Hampton blamed a few young men who had advanced so far as to discharge their pieces at them for alarming the slaves before the troops could attack. But what had really happened, more likely, the enslaved Africans had left well before the military arrived, alerted not by an antsy young white man, but by slave spies. Though they found no rebels, the militia found ample evidence of the slave's presence. His plant, Fortier, that's the plantation they was at, showed evidence that they had been there, killing poultry, cooking, eating, drinking, and quote-unquote rioting. That's how he wrote it. The military didn't know this, but they had fallen for a classic West African military ruse. Warfare practice in the Congo especially featured frequent advances and retreats intended to confuse the enemy. The Congolese soldiers would watch their enemies carefully, waiting for an opportune moment to attack. This careful strategy allowed the Congolese to use numbers to overwhelm better armed forces. The enslaved Africans' ploy had worked marvelously. Hampton and his men and their horses were too tired to pursue the quote-unquote fugitives further. And so the slave army retreated into plantation territory. The American military force took a break at that plantation. Fooled by Charles Delon and the slave rebels, the white army now faced a bleak prospect. As this is the planters who were moving forward and trying to conquer this revolt on their own. Like I had alluded to earlier, by letting Manuel Andre live instead of going and finding him and hacking him into pieces, he then hooked up with another white guy named, I think, Charles Perret, P-E-R-R-E-T, and those two put a band of about 80 farmers together, 80 white folks together, armed to the teeth, to go out and take care of business and guard their way of life, if you want to call that a way of life. So they were pressing forward, and then they thought they were also going to get some help from the military. And so we just shared that this military part didn't work, and they got tired and then decided to just chill at the plantation because they were too tired. So, yes, so the White Army now faced a bleak prospect. As they marched further into the German coast, each plantation, each grove of cypresses could shelter the slave army, and every black slave on every plantation was a potential spy or recruit. The soldiers did not know the terrain very well, and the population was clearly hostile. Any optimism Hampton might have had outside of that plantation faded quickly as his thoughts ran through his mind. So that's what was going on January 9th. Now, unfortunately, the revolt only lasted 3 days, from the 8th to the 11th. And like I said, you got to take your victories where you can. And I shared some of what was done on the 8th and on the 9th. Well, on the 9th and on the 10th. Yeah. Okay, 4 days. But 3 days, January 10th, yeah. But on that day, January 10th, the rain is still coming down. This ragtag army, like you said, of 80 planters, armed to the teeth and assembled on the levee, they had unwittingly flanked our freedom fighters. Expecting the only resistance to emerge from New Orleans, the enslaved Africans had not anticipated such a rearguard action. They had neither taken a defensive position nor steeled themselves for combat. The planters, led by Perret and Andre, had come upon them by surprise. Though the rebels formed a force more than double the size of his detachment, Perret decided to attack. If his planter militia could not defeat the slave army, he believed all would be lost. The planters' wives and children would die at the hands of a ferocious slave army, and everything they had worked for to build would burn at the torch. It was a dire thought. Summoning his men, Perret called, "Let those who are willing follow me, and let's move out." The slave army slowly formed into a line of battle. They then waited, watching as the planter militia approached slowly across the cane fields. The muskets the slaves carried were only accurate at short distances, so proper military tactics dictated that both sides must close to within 500 feet before firing a single shot. And now, I like this part here. We can never, this is all from 137, 138. We can never know the thoughts that went through. They just told me I got like a minute left, so we're going to finish it on the flip in. If you want to hear the rest of this, please, 760-454-1111. Or you can also download the archive. We're going to go ahead and continue with how we lost and what happened to us after we lost, and share some stuff, about next week's program. 760-454-1111. We will continue this in the overtime. Tune in next week. We'll talk about the Maroon communities and other enslaved African insurrections in the United States. Abibi Fahodie, Total African Liberation.
European control works is that you have to accept a concept of reality which makes them superior. If you deny that, their thing will not work, and they will lose their control.
All right, so continue. We can never know the thoughts that went through the slaves' heads as they took their stand. The two options before them were freedom or death. 50 years later, a free black man fighting with a regiment of the French-speaking ex-slaves from Louisiana described their emotions upon entering battle with the Union Army. We are now fighting, and as no more glorious death than to die for freedom. Now, let me stop. Even though he's pulling this quote from somebody who was fighting, you know, with the Union Army and this whole American thing, I do think this next quote here, and I'll go along with the author, I think this next quote here would be something that we would have been thinking as this was happening, as we set up the front line and we're about to engage in this battle. And if we whoop them, then it's on to New Orleans to take over the city and to, you know, do whatever. If not, then we die on this spot. So I think he pulled out a good quote here, and I would agree. I do think this is what we were thinking during this engagement. And I quote from 138. Before our race, to go back into bondage again, to be hunted by dogs through the swamps and cane breaks, to be set up on the block and sold for gold and silver? No, never. Gladly we would die first. Most likely the slave rebels felt the same way. And so he goes through, he talks about the weather, he talks about the environment. The cane fields form a wide, flat, open space with good visibility. Most battles, you know, are fought within a mix of woods and open spaces, lending an advantage to guerrilla tactics like those the enslaved Africans would have likely employed. But an open field favored the sort of large-scale infantry movements popular among well-drilled armies. So they were in the open cane field, so that would be advantage cracker army. But the weather was on the side of us, on the enslaved Africans. The pouring rain meant that the white militia would be unable to bring in artillery, either by river or along the Muddy River Road. They wouldn't have, and with the heavy rain, they did not have the benefits of grape shot, whatever that is, or the cannon fire as they attacked. So both sides had to fight with muskets. Staring in the face of death, the slave army did not blink. The blacks were not intimidated by this army and formed themselves in line, wrote a Spanish agent in New Orleans. Then, in an instant, the first shots rang out. The African drums beat war rhythms, and the leaders called out to the slaves to encourage them. As the first soldiers on both sides fired their muskets, clouds of smoke would have quickly poured down on both sides, hiding everything but the flash of enemy guns. Guns roared, muskets crashed and burst, bullets zipped and hissed through the air. Facing battle for the first time, the slaves could have only felt the unease and terror of confronting a danger that they could neither see nor comprehend. The slaves at first might not have recognized the noise of bullets, which could sound like fast-moving bees or birds. Amid the smoking chaos, men began to drop. Their deaths would have seemed strangely disconnected from the cacophony of noise. The bullets themselves were invisible. The leaders of the slave army watched through the smoke as their men began to fall, as bullets opened gaping wounds in the bulging muscles of the sugar workers. Perhaps the slaves discharged their weapons too early. Perhaps the white planters were simply better trained and disciplined. But within a few minutes, the slaves had discharged all of their ammunition, and the planters kept firing. The slaves watched as corpses proliferated. Their hair still wet from the recent rain, rebel slaves lay dead on the ground, their eyes glazed, their lips blue, and their last expression fixed forever in their faces. It was a horrifying sight. So, yeah. So, after we ran out of ammunition, we went up to the teeth and kept firing. And more of us started dropping, and more of us started dropping. Only then did some of us then broke ranks and decided to try to flee. We didn't have much of a lead. Come to find out, the planters had also paid some. And he doesn't give the details in here, but they had paid a party of Native Americans to help them travel through the swamps to track us down. They had got that tactic from when they were trying to squelch the Louisiana Maroon Wars. They would pay off Native Americans to track down through the swamps because they knew the territory and the environment. So they employed it here as well to track us down. And they also had bloodhounds who were trained to chase runaway enslaved Africans. A lot of the rebel group they killed on sight, and some of us, they decided to bring and put to a kangaroo court. Planters killed survivors immediately after the battle. Only about 25 prisoners, including Kwaku and Kwamina, survived two trials. After killing the slaves, the planter militia began a barbaric practice, chopping off the heads of the dead rebels as souvenirs and warnings for other slaves. The blood of the wounded, the dead, and the decapitated soaked into the cane fields. They caught up with Charles. Charles did not escape. The dogs got to him first, dragging him down and ferociously biting into his sweating flesh. The planters, recognizing Charles as the principal leader of the bandits, brought him back into the cane fields to make a public demonstration. According to one witness, the militiamen chopped off Charles's hands, broke his thighs, shot him dead, and then roasted his remains on a pile of straw. Charles died a martyr for his cause. His death cries a stirring message in the escaped slaves still cowering in the marshes. So then, from January 12th to January 21st, 1811, now with the rebellion squashed, they had their kangaroo courts. And as he, as the author rightly mentions, it wasn't a court, you know, to hear this, hear our side. It wasn't a court to find guilty or innocent. It was a court to legitimize their violence and to help reestablish the boundaries between quote-unquote civilized and quote-unquote savage. They intended the tribunals to swiftly approve the murder of all slaves involved in the uprising so that society could be reestablished to meet the planters' visions. One thing that they also did obsessively, collectively, they chopped off the heads of the slave corpses and put them on display. By the end of January 1811, around 100 dismembered bodies decorated the levees from the Place des Armes, A-R-M-E-S, in the center of New Orleans, 40 miles along the river road into the heart of the plantation district. And so this particular chapter is called Head on Poles. And so That had seemed to be the preferred European method of squelching any resistance. Once they caught the people who were involved, they would chop their heads off, put them on poles as, you know, reminders and as warning to all the other enslaved Africans to not resist or you will end up like this. And, of course, it was also a good psychological boost for the Caucasoids themselves and continued justification for their 400-year enslavement process. So the last thing we'll say about the whole thing, actually. So they, like I say, they had about 25 folks, and they would, you know, bring them in one by one and, you know, trying to get confessions from folks. And, of course, unfortunately, a whole bunch of folks started, quote-unquote, giving up other people. One guy named Charles is the principal chief of the brigands. And folks were just naming, you know, naming folks and saying, he did this and I saw him do that and I saw this and he did that and all that sort of stuff. What I will share, though, and Hey, I think you gotta have, you always gonna have some folks who are like this. Coming from 154, The final interview of the day, January 13th, was with Harry of the Kenner Estate, who had been one of those men who had met with Charles on Sunday before the revolt. Harry, unlike a few others, refused to speak or to confess. The planners sentenced him guilty on the spot. You know, of course. But Harry Kenner, you know, he's one of the four that we had mentioned, Kwaku, Kwamina, Harry, and Charles. Harry was like, I'm not going to play your little kangaroo games. He ain't speak, he ain't confess. You know, whether you talked or not, like very few, I think he said two people out of the 25, only two of them were given their freedom from either confessing or just saying, you know, flying stuff out the side of their mouth to try to get free. So, as you see, it didn't make a difference if you ratted or if you shut up. These cockroaches are going to kill you. On the morning of January 14th, after several other slaves had been interrogated, the planters called next for Kwaku. Kwaku refused to denounce any other slaves, and he would not tell the planters who participated and who did not. But he did proudly confess to one thing. Quote, he admitted that he was the one who struck Mr. Francois Trepanier with an axe, unquote. Kwaku had the records in the record books. They call him Kook. But like we said last week, when you dig a bit further, that's just a European misunderstanding of the Asante word Kwaku. Kwaku had confirmed his own death sentence. Later in the day, Kwamina, as the records call him, but probably Kwabina, again another Asante warrior, too would take the same course. Kwamina acknowledged guilt and that he had figured in a notable manner in the insurrection. He did not denounce anyone, read the transcript. These two warriors stayed true to their oath. Because right before this Sunday, right before they decided to engage, you know, they took oaths as to, you know, no one would say anything. And so, of course, you know, folks did break that and decided to give up other people. But Harry, Kwaku, and Kwamina, names who we really, really should add to our libations when they call upon, you know, personal and national ancestors. If you go to, you know, African rituals and stuff, call out Kwaku of the New Orleans 1811 Rebellion. Call out Kwabena of the New Orleans 1811 Rebellion. Call out Harry Kenner of the New Orleans 1811 Rebellion. And call out Charles DeLong of the New Orleans 1811 Rebellion. And you know, we can only speculate because they killed him on the spot, but I'd like to speculate that Charles would have done just like Kwaku and Harry and Kwamina. I ain't giving up nobody. I ain't telling nothing on nobody. I know you're going to kill me anyway, so fuck you. And so oh, I'm sorry. Let me mention a few other folks. Other slaves refused to testify or submit to the juridical powers of the planters. Robain of James Brown Plantation refused to accuse anyone. Joseph of the Trepanier Estate confessed his guilt and did not deny the charges made against him, but he did not accuse anyone. Etain and Nede of the Trask Estate did the same. So, yeah, the planters made no effort to distinguish between these slaves or to define their crimes on an individual basis. They simply categorized 18 of the 21 slaves as guilty and dismissed entirely the diversity of the slaves' testimonies. And so, yeah. So, even though they got us, we fought back. And even to the last, to their last breath, basically, you still had some folks who stood true to the oath, knew what was going on, knew they were going to die, so it wouldn't have helped to rat out and make up stuff and sell their brothers down the line and all that sort of stuff. And again, that's another lesson that we can pass on to folks. Selling out and ratting folks out in situations like that makes no never mind. You don't do that. What we say in the street, snitches catch stitches. And so one way that this whole story has been covered up for almost about exactly, a little bit more than 200 years, was the way that the governor categorized it. Because, you know, when you're a historian and you're supposed to do research, you know, the first thing you're supposed to deal with is primary sources, folks who were actually there and what they actually said. And so most folks went to the governor of Louisiana during that time. And he stripped the rebellion of revolutionary or geopolitical meaning by dismissing it as an act of base criminality. And so you got that. And so then some folks within, again, primary sources, within see what the newspapers of that time had to say, and as Daniel shows, that either the newspapers were hush about it, or when they did mention it, again, they didn't put it as far as, you know, revolutionary freedom fighters fighting enslavement in the European and American system, fighting for their freedom, you know, stuff like that. They basically just, again, called them a band of brigands whose act of criminality was easily squelched by the American military and stuff like that. And so when these historians, like Abdecker and other folks, went through the records to try to put together their stuff, there wasn't much to find as far as the primary sources. What Daniel did is he went through financial records, financial ledgers, and the court documents, and put together a database, and then created his narrative around that information. And you know, a lot of the folks who were dealing with slave revolt information usually are doing surveys of a whole bunch of slave revolts just to say, okay, there was one here, there was one here, there was one here. But as far as doing that detailed information about each specific one, Abdecker and other folks really weren't doing that. That wasn't their task. They were just there to, okay, here's some information about this revolt. This is what the paper said. Okay, let's continue, keep it going, moving on. And then the folks who did talk about it basically came from a strict white supremacist background and tone and tenor in what they talked about. And again, all that's in his cover-up chapter, which I did jump to and read first. But and then other folks who talked about it got a hold of it. They only dealt with it from a Marxist type perspective. So they still, again, didn't see African people fighting for their freedom. They saw workers fighting the petty bourgeois of that day to get class parity or some BS that those that those Marxist folks be talking about. So yeah, he does a good job of how this story has been covered up throughout the years. And we finally now have the full, a larger picture of the story. He lists a few primary documents, and one that's real good, and he says he used it a lot, was by a guy called Albert Thrasher, On to New Orleans, Louisiana's historic 1811 slave revolt. And he was like, that before this, before American Uprising, that had been the most detailed account of the 1811 revolt. But it was self-published, and you can't get a hold of it now. So he told me some ways, a way that I can try to go about getting it, you know, the same way that he did. And so I'm going to try to do that, see if I can get my hands on this book, to get more information about it. Because, again, I'm on one level, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know about it. But, again, it hadn't been put out there. It's not like, you know, something that was an elephant in the room and, you know, folks just missed it. No, it was deliberately covered up first by the governor of the state at the time. And then by, you know, further historians, whether, again, coming from a white supremacy bent or coming from a Marxist bent, no one really dug in their research heels and did the work to put together this story. You know, Abdecker did mention that it was the largest revolt, but, you know, again, he was doing a survey and didn't give a lot of information, and nobody really outside of Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, and did the work to figure this story out. I give credit to this cracker, Daniel Rasmussen, for doing that. And if you just Google his name, I think he's got a web page, and he'll be speaking all over the place. And so he'll probably be coming to an area near you. I saw he's going to be in New York, and then he's going to do some stuff on the West Coast. And so I would definitely say I do endorse this book. If for nothing else, just having the story of the revolt and having his bibliography to where you can then try to dig up the sources that he used, primary and secondary. So not only can you do the research, can you further the research, but if nothing else, by having the book, you can know about the story and tell this story to other folks and let its legacy live on. It don't matter that it wasn't successful. What matters is resistance, and we fought, and we fought proudly. And we had many, MINI, victories along the way. And even though the end result didn't end up like we wanted it to, just the resistance, just having that story of resistance is what we need. That's one reason why we still talk and praise Shaka Zulu. We forget that the British came over and got stomped and whooped about 20 times, I think, 15, 20 times. And unfortunately, it was that last battle that the British finally won. But we bring up Shaka's name because of his courage of conviction, because of his fighting tactics, because of the victories that he did get over those bastards coming in, trying to take over the land and change the culture and kill the people and rape the women, all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, even though it didn't end the way we would have wanted to, there were some victories in there. And so if we can call upon Shaka Zulu's name with reverence, even though he didn't end the way that he would have wanted to have end those battles, that last battle. Excuse me. We can call upon Kwaku and Kwamina and Harry Kenner and Charles Delon. And then others who we find fought valiantly and especially didn't sell out in the end. And call upon their names when we need extra strength to do battle against this wicked, wicked beast. Excuse me. My throat's starting to give up, so I guess that means it's time for me to shut up. So, yeah, so next week we're going to continue our resistance lecture series. Going to go through some of the maroon societies in the U.S. and possibly maybe also some other uprisings and insurrections that we had here in the States. Damn. So next week, same time, same Blog Talk channel. Please click the books. Actually, when you click American Uprising, go ahead and buy it through the click. That helped me out. Buying it through the click, it helped me out, and then clicking it helped me out. But then just click all the other ads and links. That helps. Please download it. Download the archive of it and share it with other folks. Excuse me. Yeah, it's time for me to shut up. Thanks for everyone's support. Until next week, Abibi Fahodie, Total African Liberation.